Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good.
So tonight is a big case, and we thought about putting this one off for a while, but instead we're tackling it. We're just going through with it, and it happens to be pretty popular right now because of a little documentary that came out. So what are we talking about, Aaron?
An ongoing case throughout several decades, but popularized recently on HBO by way of The Jinx. This is the story of Robert Durst and his ongoing, he has an amazing ability to avoid legal repercussions for possible actions that he has taken. And that's the best we can say, I think.
Yeah, I mean, in our last episode, I talk about people and their patterns. And if this guy doesn't have a pattern, I don't know who does.
Very true. This seems like it'd be much more obvious than most other cases we've covered.
Yeah, it's ridiculous how. Anyways, Robert Durst. He comes from the Durst real estate company. They are multi-million, maybe multi-billion-dollar company. They're huge. He's somehow gone through life with the funding of his family's money to literally get away with murder or killing people. And here he is today, and he's still in the news. So he had kind of a screwed up childhood, though, right? His mother committed suicide, and
that's up for debate.
Yeah. According to him, his father called to him and he came over, and his father said, "Wave to your mom." And he looks out the window and his mom's on the roof, and she jumps to her death. But somebody disputes that.
Well, his brother disputes that and said that never actually happened, that their mother fell from the roof of their home. Of course, just like many other things that have happened long ago, and there isn't, how should we put it, we don't have what we would consider solid information on it. Obviously, there wasn't a video camera there. So we're going off of assumption here or rumor. And they say that she possibly was disorientated because of her asthma medication and was up on the roof. I'd like to know why she was on the roof.
Well, and it was cold. It was winter. The dad just calls to him and says, "Wave to mommy," when she's on the roof. The story is kind of weird, because why wouldn't he be out there trying to get mommy off the roof and back into the warm home?
Yeah, you kind of wonder how far the apple fell from the tree. the reason why he's as wealthy as he is because his grandfather moved from Austria to the United States in 1902. And they say that at the time he didn't have very many possessions. He was pretty poor and obviously came to America to improve his, you could say, his chances for a better life. And so he worked hard and he saved his money and he got into real estate. So in 1915, he purchased his first property in New York. And by 1927, had incorporated the Durst Organization, which is how Durst, Robert Durst, ends up becoming very wealthy.
They own some pretty valuable blocks in New York and other well-to-do areas. Kind of like when you're playing Monopoly and you land on Park Place or, you know, whatever. That's the properties they own, essentially. Robert's part of this family, so everything's good, right? I mean, he's probably in line to run the company. He's probably, holding a high position in the office, and he's got his own stuff, and he's a great guy for the corporation, right?
Well, I don't know about that. I know that he attains a degree in economics by attending university, and then he enrolls at UCLA in 1965, and he meets one of the other people that's in this story, a major player in this story named Susan Berman.
So Susan and him are friends. They never claim to be lovers. Susan is the daughter of a mafioso guy and a gangster, and so she meets Robert and, you know, it's kind of the same level, caliber, like rich people, high rollers, rock star lifestyle. And she goes on to write two books. One's called Lady Las Vegas. And they're both books about growing up in a mafia style family.
Yeah, that's what's said. But what's odd is that he drops out of school in 1969 and goes back to New York. Mm-hmm. So you'd think with that much time there at UCLA that he would have accomplished something, but do you know if he was able to attain a degree or anything?
I didn't really look that much into his college stuff because, I mean, to put it bluntly, he's from a very well-to-do family. What does he need a degree for? He doesn't need one. I mean, he can get one, and it's paper certificate that says he's smart, but he doesn't really need it.
Well, he may need it. I guess it depends because if he's going to be a part of this company, he needs to bring something to it, I would think, even if he is already wealthy, if he wants to help run it. But I guess that's part of the story because I would say that he did a pretty good job of making sure that he wasn't in line to run that company.
Yeah.
And do you think that was on purpose, or do you think he's just got a really wacky personality?
Both. I mean, he seems to not have that much interest in the business. He seemed to be, I don't know if he would be considered like a free-spirited artist by any means, but he didn't really show a lot of interest in real estate. Apparently, he doesn't get along very well with his brother, so whether or not he right from the beginning showed no interest or slowly just kind of pulled out of it, but he does have a wacky personality regardless. So I don't know if that had any factor into his disinterest in the business.
I don't know if it's like a personality quirk, but he has a nasty habit of urinating in public.
And yes, he does.
One of the things that we see early on with him is that he urinates in waste baskets at the company, which is pretty foul, I would say. I don't know anybody that would think that was a good idea.
Yeah, this is just my own interpretation, but I would say that that's a show of disrespect for the company.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's sort of a sign. He's letting everyone know that he doesn't respect anybody. And I think that's a running theme throughout this entire story, is that he really just doesn't have respect for anybody else.
Shall we move on to Kathleen meeting his wife?
Right. That's in 1971.
71, he meets Kathleen, and he actually is running a small business, like a Whole Foods kind of little grocery store called All Good Things. And sort of ominous sort of title when you, in retrospect, but it's, you know, that's what he's doing with her at that point. Now, most people would probably start with Kathleen, or maybe most people would even, you know, the way the documentary The Jinx started was with Morris Black. But to me, the disappearance of Lynn Schultz back in 1971 is the first kind of thing on record of there's a woman, 18 years old, disappears. And she had a low opinion about his store. They got into an altercation of some kind, an argument. And he was the last person seen around her. An artist did a sketch up, and it closely resembles Robert Durst. But they had nothing. Lynn Schultz is the first person in his life that goes missing. Because the whole idea of the Jinx is, either he's a jinxed person, or if you hang out with them, you might be jinxed. Essentially, Lynn is the first one.
1971, he meets Kathleen McCormick, which is the same year that Lynn Schultz goes missing. Lynn went missing very late that year. Essentially, what is said is that he dated her, or I guess you could say was seeing her, for 2 days before they moved in together. So it was very quick. And that's another thing that we see with Durst, is he doesn't really seem to be romantically interested in these women that he's connecting with. That's the sense that I got anyway. And so, yes, within a couple of years, he marries her.
They go on to get married, and he doesn't take a strong interest in her side of the family. At family gatherings, he doesn't really interact with them much. That's just the way, you know, her family interpreted him, and, you know, they tried to accept him in, but they say that he just didn't have any interest. And I realize that when people get married, they're, you know, one side or the other is always, doesn't always work out that way, but it's just something to keep in mind when they got married. And so their marriage is, I guess it's probably okay at the beginning, like most marriages are, but kind of goes downhill, and they argue a lot. They fight a lot, and she's going to school, and they're kind of, I just didn't see a lot of chemistry, let's say, there. Kathleen's friends say that they fought, and they say that, 3 weeks before Kathleen went missing, she actually went to the hospital with bruising to her face and head. Either she took a tumble down some stairs, or they're fighting, it turned physical. And that's pretty much what's the wound she had when she went to the hospital pretty much coincide with somebody slapping her and beating her. So she also, she'd asked him for a divorce. She asked for $250,000, like, severance during the divorce. At that time that she was asking for the divorce, it is said that Robert was actually dating another woman, Prudence Farrow, who is the sister of Mia Farrow. And Prudence is actually credited for being the lady that the Beatles song Dear Prudence is based off of. So she's, you know, high society, and it's claimed that he was dating her. Another schism in the relationship, I think it was in 1976, she gets pregnant. Kathleen gets pregnant, and Robert demands that she has an abortion because he doesn't want kids. She might not have been completely on board with this decision, but she went through with it. And I'm sure there's some resentment there. When Robert's asked about this, he says, "Hey, I don't want kids." And when he's pressed on the subject, he says, "Well, she was dating other people, so it probably wasn't even mine anyways." Well, her friends don't give any claim that she was dating other people. She was pretty much with Robert. But meanwhile, he is dating other people. So that, I don't know, that paints a really rocky relationship to me.
We need to talk about Audible. Who is the sponsor of this episode that we are doing on Robert Durst?
There are so many options to buy books. And now that I have a subscription, I get one free book a month. And I get to choose from, what, over 100,000 titles?
It's 180,000 titles.
That's crazy.
They just increased it. Name one of the titles you got, because this always fascinates me. You always seem to get different titles. Sometimes you get fiction. Sometimes you get nonfiction.
The last book I got was Command Authority. It was a Tom Clancy book. Trying to listen to some military thriller.
Well, I'm going to recommend an audiobook for the listeners, and that would be To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee.
And it's narrated.
Right. It's narrated by Sissy Spacek. And what I find interesting about this is that, of course, Harper Lee has been in the media again because she's written, well, she had written it long ago, but she has another book that's directly tied into To Kill a Mockingbird.
I did not know that.
See, what happened was she had written the original story. If I'm not mistaken, it came down to the editor, but they say, wait, you need to tell this story. So To Kill a Mockingbird was actually not her first choice, but it's what was pushed forward. And of course, if you're trying to get published, you need to listen to your editor. But I would say that's a pretty good combination, Sissy Spacek reading To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, who's going to pass that up? And as Justin said, you know, if you get it, and then one thing that can happen is you could get an audiobook, and while you like the material, you like the story, you may not like the narrator. And I've run across that at least once. I know I'm not a big audiobook listener, but I've had some. If the narrator isn't to your liking, sometimes it's not even that they have a voice that you don't like. Sometimes it's just the way they read it. And that's pretty crucial. And I'd say overall, they do a good job of choosing who's narrating these stories. But from time to time, you'll run across someone who just doesn't work for you. So you can actually return it and get a different book. So if you have 180,000 titles to choose from, there's no way you can't find something of interest to you. And if you've been on the fence about it, there's no harm in trying. And you can get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook. All you have to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/Generation Y. If you're listening to us, you know how to spell Generation Y, but I'll say it, GenerationWhy. audiblepodcast.com/Generation Y. Just that it seemed like a loveless marriage, that he was very possessive and abusive towards her, especially as time went on. And then, of course, I don't know if the hospital visit was perhaps the catalyst that led to her disappearance, or there's so many ways you could go with this. I'm sure there are people who defend him and would probably say, oh, well, she just ran off. I'm sure some will say that, because we hear that time and time again. There are apologists. Now, I don't know how strongly I would stress that term, because we just don't have any information. She's just gone. And I also don't know how good these investigators are that work the case, because we don't have any information. Did you find any information on this? She's listed as a missing person, correct?
Yeah. So
this is 1982.
The night she disappeared, she actually had gone to her friend's house, Gilberta, and she showed up very upset and crying, and her friends are kind of trying to take care of her. And at around 7 p.m., Robert calls over there and asks for her. They get into an argument over the phone, and he's like, you need to come home right now. So she leaves, and all of her friends are really worried about her, because they know that they're in a really screwed up abusive relationship. Because it's pretty obvious to most friends that are outside of an abusive relationship what's going on. she goes home and she has to go to school the next day. Robert claims that he takes her to the train station and drops her off. She gets on the train, goes back to their apartment that they own that's in the city. Their little cottage home is in Salem. And so she gets on the train, goes home. The next day, the school gets a call and a lady says, "This is Kathleen. I'm really sick. I won't be showing up for class today." So the school thinks, okay, no problem. And a few more days go by and the school is now calling around saying, "Where's Kathleen? She hasn't shown up." Kathleen's friend is calling around trying to figure out where Kathleen is because she's not returning her phone calls because she's really worried about her friend that just left her house in tears after getting a very angry phone call from her husband and after confiding in her that she's going to leave her husband. So the investigators, so her friend is actually the one that pretty much gets the police to start a missing persons report. It's not Robert. Robert gets pretty much interrogated by the police and he says, "I dropped her off at the train station. I called her later to, you know, and talk to her on the phone. She was there at home. She was fine." That's what he tells the investigators. They say, "Well, what did you do?" And he said, "Well, I dropped her off the train station. I went to my neighbor's house and had some drinks. And then I went on home." And then he changes his story later. And he says that he dropped her off and then he went straight home and went to sleep. He just says different things. And in the documentary, he's like, "I just told the police whatever. I was just hoping they'd just go away." At that point, he's just telling the investigators any old story of where he was that night just to make them go away. If your wife is missing, are you just going to be, you know, "Oh, just go away. Like, here's my story. I was at home or I was at my neighbor's house drinking. And that's what I'm sticking to." That's how he comes off. You know, just, "I wanted the investigators to go away."
It sounds like there's a lack of respect there again. That it's like he's real dismissive. He's like, "Eh, those guys just buzz off."
His old friend, Susan, comes back into the picture to support him because his wife is now missing. Susan behaves as his PR rep and talks to the media for him because when you see this guy talk, let's just say that he doesn't come across very well. You know, maybe it's because he's from New York. Maybe it's just, you know, his lackadaisical tone, whatever, but he shouldn't be put in front of cameras. So Susan does most of his talking. She tells the media that, you know, this is his movements during the night. He dropped her off the train station, da da da. She arrived at the building. The doorman greeted her and let her into the building. You know, she got to the apartment and then called the school and then she disappeared the next day. "So please help us find her." And she starts like kind of a whole missing persons, you know, campaign to find Kathleen. You know, let's go back to another case we just did about parents and a missing child and driving the case, driving the media, you know, driving the investigation the way they want to. So already Robert and Susan have said, "This is the way it went, and here's the media," and the media keeps repeating this. The doorman saw her arrive. But in reality, the doorman cannot confirm that he saw Kathleen ever arrive at that apartment building. If she never arrived, then the last person to see her was her husband when he dropped her off at the train station, right? I think we've done enough cases, Aaron, where we know that if a spouse or a significant other goes missing or is murdered, who's the number one suspect in all those cases?
Well, that's pretty obvious.
Always the husband or the wife. I mean, they're always the number one suspect.
They ought to be the number one suspect if they're doing the investigation properly anyway.
At this point, Susan's pretty much driven the case away from Robert and they're really just investigating the missing persons. They're not investigating Robert at all. They don't search his house. They don't bring them into for any more questioning. They just move on and say there's no leads. Kathleen's friend is not happy with this. She's not happy with the investigation. So she actually goes and breaks into Robert's house, the cottage in Salem, trespassing, breaking and entering. She goes there and she finds that Robert is already thrown away most of Kathleen's stuff. He's got garbage bags of all her stuff just built up in the closets and the rooms. He's taken all her mail and thrown it in the trash, bills, things like that, that you would probably think, you know, even if she's gone, he might want to keep some of these things around because she hasn't been missing that long. So she calls the investigators of the case and says, I broke into his house and here's what I found. Please send an officer out. And they won't do it. They won't even send an officer out to arrest her for breaking and entering. So, yeah, the investigation right off the bat for Kathleen's disappearance, pretty much a fail. They go into to phone records, and this is something that I think Robert doesn't really have a good grasp on technology. So Robert doesn't like paying for phone calls, and he has pretty much like a calling card or a collect call service that he can use for the Durst company. So when he picks up a payphone, he can dial some numbers or call the operator and make a collect call, and it gets billed back to his family's company. And he's down in these this shipyard, these ship bottoms, and he makes a couple collect calls. He claims that they weren't his. It wasn't him. Somebody else had to have made collect calls using the company's name. And when you ask people at the Durst company, they say, no, only he's the only guy that does that. And the location of where the payphone was that he made these calls from was pretty close to his Salem home. So what are the chances that somebody else was there making phone calls using his calling card, essentially? He doesn't have a good grasp on that.
Well, you could say he doesn't, but does anyone else?
Well, for him to flat out deny that he made those phone calls when it's obvious they came from him.
No, I don't disagree with you. I don't dispute what you're saying, but what does it amount to, right?
Well, a little foreshadowing, let's just say.
Sure. We can take that.
Yeah. So then we got two disappearances now. May or may not have been him. Just we got two now. 1997, a teen girl named Karen Mitchell goes missing, and she had some sort of interaction with Robert before she went missing. I'll be honest, I didn't go into a lot of detail on Karen's disappearance, but they're the only suspect in that is pretty much Robert. There's a third disappearance in his life. Robert moves on. We're looking at December 2000. The cops are kind of reopening his missing wife's case. Susan Berman is living out in Los Angeles, and she's like an author, and she has her little business, but she's not doing too well. So this is before the days of GoFundMe, but she was asking her friends and family for money, and Robert would send her checks for $25,000. That's a lot of money. Now he's got that kind of money, right? I mean, he's rich.
But do we know that it's to support her?
Exactly. Is this checks to, hey, I hope your business does really good? Or is this a check for, hey, I hope your business does really good and you don't talk about my wife's disappearance, hush, hush money? It's possible.
Well, there's a third possibility too, which is...
What's that?
Her father's mafioso, you say?
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't she just kind of drop a little hint to him, like, you know, I'm a little strapped for cash, and whatever happened to your wife again? I guess the reason I bring that up is because of what we're coming up to in regards to what happens to Susan Berman. So there must be a reason for animosity here. What happens with this situation?
Well, Susan gets a call from the authorities saying that they're reopening they're reinvestigating the case of Kathleen's disappearance, and that she called Robert to explain to him that they're coming to question her about it. So that was right before she's murdered. Happens that in the same week that Susan is murdered, Robert is actually visiting California. He's in Northern California, and Susan is in Los Angeles, Southern California. She's shot in the back of the head. A letter is sent to the authorities with a letter in it that says cadaver at this address. And the address is in Beverly Hills, but Beverly is spelled incorrectly. It's spelled B-E-V-E-R-L-E-Y, and it's written in like crappy block lettering. So the cops go and they investigate this address, and they find Susan Berman's body with a bullet in the back of her head. The cops don't investigate Robert, maybe because they don't have any information about the guy. Maybe it's just whatever, but they take Susan, who is the daughter of, you know, a daughter in a mafia family, and says, well, maybe she pissed somebody off. You know, she wrote two books about being in a mob family. So Easy Street, she wrote in like 1981, and Lady Las Vegas, she wrote in 1988. And it is now the year 2000, and she's getting hit. Mafia's doing a hit on her for a book she wrote 10, 15 years ago. I don't know how the LAPD kind of makes that connection. Ask Robert where he was. He just says, oh, I was in Northern California, and I was here, and I got a car in this, you know, town. But then they actually track that he was going south. So they can follow him from very Northern California down to like San Francisco, which is still considered Northern California, but that's kind of mid California. At that point, it's like, well, why would he go so many hundreds of miles south if he's not going all the way south? When they ask him on the documentary, pretty much he says, California is a big state. That's his response. Not so his friend Susan's dead, murdered. She has a funeral, and he is still in. He says he's in California, where he, you know, people say he was, but he doesn't attend her funeral. He says he's upset about his friend's murder and her death, but he doesn't go to her funeral. Back to that respect thing.
Right. And you wonder where you take this. Do you say it's just not respect, or is it that he doesn't want to be there for very good reasons, or is it just both? Mm-hmm. Maybe that's how he ends up in these spots. It seems bloody obvious that she lets him know what's happening, and then, well, she may have good information. What does she know? It seems as though, I don't know if you exactly call it friendship, but they've been connected for quite a long time, and she may have been, out of all the people in this case, may have known him better than anyone. Once she disappears, you think, well, you know, who stands to benefit?
There's only one person, and that's Robert.
Right. So this is coincidence? Well, yeah, sure, you could say that. But there's a lot of coincidence here. So again, jinx.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
So moving on, because this is where it gets really interesting, I think, is Robert moves to Galveston, Texas. A little, you know, shorefront town, and he goes under an alias, and he has disguised himself, and he lives in this crappy little apartment in the basement of this building. And no offense to anyone if you live in a little apartment in the basement of a building, but I saw the documentary, and you know, it doesn't look that nice. And his alias is a mute old lady, which is pretty incredible. So the landlord only knows him via email and stuff, letter, you know, rent checks and whatever. But the neighbor down the way, Morris Black, is older gentleman who lives in the building. And I guess him and Robert start talking and become friends. According to Robert, they're friends. They hang out, they watch TV, they go out for coffee and whatever together, all these things, right?
Yeah, if you take his word for it.
But how we find out about Morris Black isn't because of his friendship with Robert. We find out about Morris Black because dismembered parts of his body wash up on shore in garbage bags. So the police are investigating pieces of this body, a torso, legs, and arms. And they identify it as Morris. And they go back to the apartment complex where he lives, right? And,
well, but who's there? Robert Durst isn't there, right?
Yeah. The mute lady is.
There's a mute woman there. And you have to think, this is a very, very wealthy person. And he's renting a $300 a month apartment. Yeah. And posing as a woman. And I don't know how many people know this. Maybe it was covered. I did not see the Jinx.
Oh.
But he was known for having many, many pseudonyms and many, many fake business names. You have to think why he doesn't just exist as Robert Durst constantly. You know what I'm saying? He has credit. He has credit cards. He has things under other names.
Multiple identities.
What is this evidence of? This is a person who's high profile and yet is trying to be exactly the opposite much of the time.
He's hiding. He's in hiding. He's running from things.
Yeah, he's constantly hiding, which is another clue, I think, to this whole case. He's definitely hiding. He's definitely covering something up. And he's trying to throw people off his scent, I guess you could say. But yeah, he doesn't seem to do a very good job of that.
The investigators that are investigating the case for Morris Black they go to question the old mute lady in the apartment, and there's Robert, and he says he just moved in there. He says he doesn't know the mute lady that lived there before him. Even his wife, who is questioned by the police, says he moved to Galveston after the murder. A little bit of lying and, you know, whatever. So the cops are looking for somebody that has a saw to essentially chop up a body with. And they catch Robert with a bow saw in his car and a receipt for multiple purchases he had made at a hardware store at about the same time for items that would be really good at dismembering a body. This is clean cut case. Like they find his apartment. They find blood in the apartment. They find cuts in the linoleum in the kitchen. They pull it all up and they know that Robert was living there for a long time before the murder. And he is the only suspect in the case. So they charge him with the murder of Morris Black. His bond is set at like $300,000. Well, I don't think they really understood who they were dealing with, because Robert calls his wife, gets bonded out because $300,000 is nothing to him. And at that point, he shaves his head and all the facial hair, even his eyebrows, he just shaves everything. And he has his wife send him a bunch of cash. And he goes incognito. Not that he wasn't already there, but now he's like, you know, Heisenberg from Breaking Bad. And for some reason, he goes into a little market store and shoplifts a chicken sandwich and a Band-Aid. They're watching him on the cameras, and they just bust him because he wasn't going to go back to court. He wasn't going to defend himself. He just was, nope, I bonded out and I'm taking off. He's fleeing at this point. He goes to trial. And what do you think of this trial, Aaron?
Well, at the crux of the trial is the defense comes up with that there was a struggle over a gun because Morris Black and Durst had been fighting. There was a struggle over a gun and Black was killed in self-defense. And of course, the prosecutors were arguing that Black was murdered. So what they had to do is they had to convince the jury, the defense did, that this was self-defense. And to give you some idea of how well this trial went, they were able to get the jurors to laugh more than once. And they would remarks, I guess, like, you know, sometimes you just have to kill somebody.
Well, I mean, this is Texas, Aaron.
Well, yeah. I mean, don't mess with Texas, right? I believe he paid the lawyers. He had three high-powered lawyers. He paid them over $1 million. Maybe it was 1.2, or it was quite a bit of money. And they earned every penny because they went over the jury during the trial.
Morris shot the gun at either an eviction notice or something. And Morris, they never found his head. They only found his legs and his hands and, you know, but they never found his head. Robert says that they got into a struggle. Morris had a gun. Then Robert, you know, got the gun and they struggled, and then he shot Morris in the head. But we don't know where he shot Morris. We assume he shot him in the head because that's where he said he did. But we don't have Morris's head to verify this. Also, the bullet hole in the apartment is like in the wall. So the story's loose at best. There's no hole in the eviction notice where Robert says that this whole altercation went down. Also, Robert has to change his tune from Morris and I were friends to Morris was a grumpy bully that, you know, they pretty much had to do a full character assassination of Morris and paint him as a terrible person, you know, combative. Here we are. Morris is the bad guy, and Robert defended himself. somehow they didn't, the prosecution's like, okay, so he kills him, he chops him up, he bags him up, and then he throws all of his body parts in the ocean, which literally just washed back onto shore. They didn't sink. The defense pretty much says, all you have to figure out is if he defended himself, if he killed this guy in self-defense. It doesn't matter about dismembering the body. It doesn't matter about dumping the body. In the jinx, they go into great detail into the trial. The prosecution doesn't charge him with tampering with evidence. They don't charge him with doing things to a dead body. They don't charge him with anything. They just go after him for murder. He is found not guilty. And at that point in watching the documentary, my wife jumps off the couch and says, they didn't even get him for littering, which I couldn't agree more at that point. The guy fully admits to killing another person, dismembering their body, and dumping the body parts in the ocean, and they don't even get him for littering. What's going on with Texas here?
Well, if this was anyone else, I'm sure you could look at that trial and say, yeah, they should find not guilty because they don't have enough evidence, right?
Yeah. And that's kind of the thing here is, if you isolate the Morris Black incident, you got a point. It can be self-defense. If you isolate down Susan Berman and just say, hey, she was murdered, she was shot in the back of the head, and you don't look at anything else, you don't have a lot of evidence for Robert. If you isolate or compartmentalize down his missing wife, I mean, what do you got there? But this is where I get pissed, because I see other people with way less evidence getting charged with these things. And here we are with Robert skating by, which is insanity to me.
Looking at the trial the way it is, I think it is as simple as which lawyers were able to win over the jury. And not even with evidence. I think it was the way they spoke to him. There's not a lot of there's not enough evidence. I mean, you could say they could have nailed him some way or another to get him in prison or something for a little bit. But I think they needed to go all in, because as we're seeing, and we have more to talk about, obviously, but where does this rank for you in terms of cases they can make against him? Because for me, perhaps this is why the jinx focuses on this, is that Morris Black case is the best case they could have brought against him, given how little evidence there is from case to case. This one seemed to be the best case to bring forward and try to prosecute him on.
Well, I mean, it wasn't like the investigators are looking at all the cases. This is just when he finally screwed up enough that it was blatantly obvious it was him, and he had enough money to hire a legal team to prove self-defense. You know, I look back at the jury duty I was on. They didn't just charge this guy with, murder. They charged him with committing a crime with a firearm. They charged him with a slew of things. So if Robert's admitting to chopping a body up and dumping it, again, why not, why just go for a murder charge? Why not tack on other charges that could serve maybe 1 or 2 years in jail, tampering with evidence or, messing with an investigation? I mean,
it's hard to say, but perhaps they wouldn't have been able to get even those charges to stick, since if the defense had won over the jury, how much were they going to be able to get out of them? Yeah, it just comes down to they were able to win them over personally, and that seemed to be enough.
I know you didn't watch the documentary. I did, and I want to say that it is really well done. But at the same time, I understand that it is very biased. It is very, a filmmaker or producer, whoever, really wants to show you what they want to show you. And I know that reality shows are not real. I had a friend that went and got a tattoo from Kat Von D. He had a tattoo from Kat 2 years before he went on the reality show. I mean,
I get that it's all scripted and it's fudged. But in the case of the Jinx, you know, that he filmed that documentary over, I think, 2 years. So, and in the documentary, it kind of makes it look like it's over a period of a few months. And for storyline and essentially entertainment, he makes a storyline out of it. There's certain things that happen in the Jinx that actually happen pretty close to the beginning, but they don't show you those things until the very end because it makes for better ratings and it makes it more exciting. All that said, Robert is Robert in this show, and he doesn't do himself any favors whatsoever. And when it comes to just him talking, that's real. That's him. That's him answering questions. That's him responding to stuff. And there's no editing magic there because they pretty much let him go. If you want to say that, he might be a nice guy off camera. Well, that's when that documentary gets really interesting, because it's everything he says when he thinks the cameras are off and the microphone is off that makes that whole documentary gold. Me saying he doesn't have a very good understanding of technology. I don't think this guy is like a serial killer that wants to get caught. I think he really just is clueless. And so a couple times they turn off the cameras and they stop the interview, and he says stuff into his hot mic that is extremely damning to himself.
Is it,
and
though?
I think yeah.
Well, I've listened to this a number of times. I did listen to the audio. In fact, when I did the update, did you see the update I did on Facebook for this?
Brilliant.
Well, yes. Every Thursday, you know, I post the update to let people know what the next episode will be on. And I figured you'd like it. I know Justin's really amped for this episode, but I'll read you what he says when his mic's hot and he thinks no one's listening, no one's watching. And here it is. He says, "There it is. You're caught. You're right, of course, but you can't imagine. Arrest him. I don't know what's in the house. Oh, I want this. What a disaster. He was right. I was wrong. And the burping. I'm having difficulty with the question. What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course." So if you actually listen to that audio, and I didn't read it exactly as it is stated, you'll have to check it out. You can find this audio on the web. But what struck me about it was, there, depending on your point of view, you could take this any number of ways. So
hold on real quick though, Aaron, or go ahead, but I want to frame it for you when he says those things. So
why don't you frame it first? Because I can say this either way.
The last part where he's like, well, there it is, you know, they caught me, da 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 da, is when the filmmakers show him a letter that he wrote to Susan. Then they pull up the letter that's written to the police saying there's a cadaver at Susan's address. And the address on the letter written to the police and the address that he wrote to Susan personally, the handwriting is exactly the same. And Beverly is spelled wrong on both letters.
In the exact
Pretty
same
much
way.
In the exact same way.
Right.
And I don't care about handwriting analysis. If you look at it and it's that similar, I don't need a handwriting analysis guy to say all his N's are the same or all his whatevers are the same. No, the same guy wrote that letter. So he knew that she was murdered in her house, and he sent a letter from literally Beverly Hills to the police in there. So it's like, okay, if nothing else, you're at least a conspirator to this crime. I don't know.
No, I don't dispute that. And if you ask the investigators, they will say it's the letter that got him arrested, not the audio from this episode. But what I was going to say is, if you just listen to it, and maybe it's because I didn't watch the entire show, but when I was listening to it, I thought there were different ways I could take this. I could take it as, yeah, this sounds like an admission. But he's also stating things that I can't, and maybe it's because I didn't watch the show, but not all of this goes together, possibly. Like, what do you think he means by burping?
When they show him these two letters, he has a visceral reaction. And he starts stumbling over his words, and he starts literally having a panic attack on film. And he starts inadvertently or involuntarily burping.
Okay.
After they show him the two letters. So okay. That's what the burping comment's about.
The other thing here is we talked before about his lack of respect.
Yeah.
And I wonder if he's just, obviously he knows this is, I'll say this. He could probably be standing there going, they're not going to get him, but they could at the very least arrest him and make him go to trial again, which I'm sure he doesn't want. So this is going to be a huge inconvenience for him. But I almost wonder if this is a statement where he's playing this game where you know his lawyers are going to argue and say that this should not be admissible.
And no, you're right.
This is like a lack of respect for investigators to feed them this and then to hopefully watch it get yanked out from underneath them to where it's inadmissible. And he can look them in the eye and smile knowing, hey, you guys know what I'm up to, but you're never going to get me.
He's going to hire $1 million worth of legal defense, and they're going to flip it into something that makes him look good. They're going to explain every detail away and destroy the theory that he is incriminating himself with these comments.
So do you expect this to be admissible in court?
That's a hard one, because you got to find a juror that hasn't seen the documentary. You got to find a juror that's never heard of this guy, and you got to find a juror that's, you got a lot of aspects there. Here it is. It's in a documentary film. The guy that made the film didn't turn over the letters to the law enforcement or the investigators until after his, documentary aired. Because, well, why would he, give up so much money on such a cool documentary by getting Robert arrested before he's done with it? So here he is. I mean, I can see them throwing out the evidence as, well, it's been tampered with. They can throw out the evidence saying, well, this was in a film, so you can't use it for trial because it's already been put out there in public. There's 100 ways they can probably get this to be inadmissible.
From what I understand, the argument's going to come down to the legality of it, and that, at least from the people I heard analyzing it, they expect this to be admissible. But let's say so. Even for the sake, because this doesn't involve the government, essentially.
No.
And so he can his own words can be used against him.
Yeah.
There was no trickery. He did it himself. So, and I agree with that. I think it will be admissible. That's just my take on it. But even if you were to say it wasn't admissible, the judge can say this has no bearing on the case. Because he gives instructions to the jurors.
I don't think it'll be admissible for the disappearance of his wife, Kathleen. But I think it should be admissible for the investigation into Susan's death. But
well,
I'm not a lawyer.
Think about which trial he's looking at possibly having to go through.
It's the Susan one, right?
Right. See, his wife isn't considered a murder victim. She's still a missing person.
Yeah.
They haven't declared her legally dead yet, have they?
Actually, they did.
They did? When did they do this?
2001, they declared her legally deceased.
But not a murder victim.
No, just legally deceased.
Okay, so that's what I'm trying to clear up here.
Yeah.
If she's not a murder victim, they're obviously not trying to find her killer.
I don't know if they'll ever charge him with that. The prosecutor in New York is gunning for him, but she's gotta gather enough evidence. And right now, she just doesn't have enough. All she has is Kathleen's family members giving her essentially these, you know, anecdotal stories. And she has Robert's own story of the events of that night that don't add up and have been proven to be lies, essentially. But can they go interview the doorman now and say, hey, think back 30 years ago, do you remember Kathleen walking into the thing? It's just, it's not going to work out. It's going to be really hard to prosecute that case.
Well, that's something that happens over time. The further you get away from the event, the more difficult it is to use eyewitness evidence. It's just, you know, memories are bad enough as it is. And you put decades on there, it's just, it gets worse.
You know, so they can say, oh, well, he threw away her stuff. He didn't, you know, they didn't get along. They can say a lot of things, but it's going to be really hard for them. Now, personally, I think he is the only suspect and should be the prime suspect in that case for his wife.
I'm sure we could take a poll of our audience. You know, I know we don't have most of our audience on our Facebook page. We'd like to get more of them on there, but with the number of people that are on there, if we took a poll, I'd be willing to bet that the majority of people would say he should be the prime suspect in all of these cases that he's been tacked onto. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he should be convicted in those cases. It just means that we see him as the likely perpetrator of these crimes.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I don't think you are capable of dismembering a body and disposing of it. Again, kind of like our last one, I think that there's a pattern, and that the fact that he's capable of doing that to Morris Black means that he's capable of a lot more. I know that's hearsay, I know that's an opinion, but I couldn't dismember a body. That's just not something I could do.
It seems very, yeah, you think about it and you think there's no way I could do that. We know his brother's not a fan of him. I believe his name's Douglas Durst.
Yeah.
And so Douglas has said things over time to shoot down any kind of character that his brother might have. And of course, he started with the whole story about their mother saying, oh yeah, that never happened. Our dad didn't approach him and say, you know, look, that didn't happen. He also says that Robert Durst had these Alaskan Malamutes and that there were in total 7 over time and that they were all named Igor. And now, believing Douglas Durst here, he says that they were all killed by Robert Durst. None of them made it more than 6 months and that it's possible or it seems likely that he was practicing killing and disposing of bodies by doing it to the dogs. Had you heard this?
Yeah, that's right, before his wife's disappearance.
And Robert Durst, he denies this. He says that he only had 3 and that one got ran over. I mean, he has these different stories for what happened and that actually the third one lasted a while, for a long time. But here's the funny thing. When he's in was it a Philadelphia jail? He was recorded, and he actually mentions that he would like to Igor his brother. So we don't know if this is a contextual thing, because I didn't hear the entire audio here, but we don't know if he was making mention of his brother's claims of this and was like, well, I'd like to do that to you, even though it didn't really happen, or if he's basically saying, yeah, I did do that, and I would like to do the same thing to my brother.
And his brother had filed protection orders and restraining orders against Robert. And there's actual video of Robert going to his brother's place, walking up the stairs. And it's just pathetic seeing Robert do this. And so his brother's like, hey, he violated, you know, my restraining order, charge him. And the police actually ended up dropping the charges. I mean, it's just creepy. It's just really creepy. And Robert is known to own multiple guns and threaten his brother and try to Igor him. So, yeah. And after the Jinx documentary came out, his brother went on record saying, I'm glad you made it that way. I thought you were going to give him a fair shake. Well, I think they kind of did. They sort of let Robert hang himself in that documentary. I don't think they really had to paint him in a bad light, because he did a fine job on his own. And if Robert's lawyers would have known how that was going to go, I don't think they would have allowed him to be on that film at all.
Well, it's not really up to them, is it? They're not even his PR people. They're just the people who have to clean up his messes. But I'm sure if he had asked them, they would, of course, say, why are you making a documentary? You don't need the money. You certainly don't need or want the publicity. What is this about? Again, I would submit we're looking at a guy who has no respect for others and obviously has an inflated sense of self here. Pretty well pleased with himself.
Yeah. He goes on record saying he wants to tell his side of the story, which, boy, he sure did that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the reasons we're talking, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think you should watch it, Aaron, just for entertainment value, if nothing else. I would put it up there right with The Staircase as far as interest goes.
Yeah, I was going to say that it reminds me, not that I've seen it, but it reminds me of The Staircase in that they focus on a defendant and his side of things, which, you know, The Staircase does as well, probably influence some people watching it or quite a few people who watched it. And I'm sure in the Durst case, I don't know, how did you take it? Did you have a feeling on him before you watched it? And then once you finished watching it, did you have a completely different feeling about him? Or
to be honest, I didn't. I know who he was. I'd heard his name mentioned before. But going into that documentary, I had no clue. I went into it cold, essentially. So I formed a little bit of my opinion while I watched it. But at the same time, I kept a very open mind because I didn't want to form an opinion until after I'd researched. So again, it's one of those things where I took it as more or less a reality show and not a documentary. And I went into it saying, you know, they could script this, they could, you know, they could make this look however they want. So I kept an open mind, but reading up on like the Charlie Project site and a few other websites, it's, again, I'm a true believer that people follow a pattern. People can be scripted in their own real reality life. And Robert follows a pattern here, and that pattern is one of death and destruction.
But not leaving much evidence behind, apparently. So maybe we touched on this already, but what's the final verdict here? Do you believe that Robert Durst will ever get sent back to prison at all? Do you think he'll serve time, or do you think he's going to get off the hook again?
Let's just put it this way. I think he's guilty as hell, but I will not be surprised if he walks. I know that's probably not what everyone wants to hear, but you have a good enough legal team. We've seen this, you know, you have a good enough lawyer. You're walking. That's how it is.
Yeah, I would say, being very impartial, but I haven't seen anything on him video-wise, I would say they don't really have anything on him, not enough to put him away like the way they want to, I would say. And so I fully expect him to not be incarcerated in the future in relation to his wife's disappearance or the death of Susan Berman. I see him just being free in the future.
And if this was anyone else, we wouldn't even be having this discussion.
Well, because we wouldn't know who the hell they were.
They'd be sitting in jail.
maybe. But I'm not sure they have any evidence on him. That's the whole problem here. I mean, it's not like bullets are fired. They have the gun that fired the bullets, do they? I just don't see what they have. I think what happens is they have the letter. As you put it, very well, they have this letter that seems very damning. Sure, that's very suspicious. But what does it really mean in the end? You have to prove murder here.
All you can get is accessory. You can get maybe, you know, they can say, oh, well, he showed up at her apartment to come visit her, and he found her body and then wanted to let the authorities know. I mean, that's even better than a self-defense. Hey, I found her and I wanted to notify somebody. Even though he denies writing the letter, it's a simple legal defense. Going off the Morris Black case, he can change his entire story before the court case and get away with it.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.